Environment to order, and we'll be having an informational meeting today. So let's ask Matt Blevins, Oregon Environmental Council, to come talk.
Oh, hiding. I didn't see it.
Greetings.
Greetings. Thank you, Chair Anderson and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Matt Blevins. I'm the Legislative Affairs Director with the Oregon Environmental Council. I thought I'd just take a few minutes to talk to you a little bit about OEC, as well as about our legislative priorities for this session and some of the other issues that we're going to be looking at. Unsure how many of those are going to end up in this committee, but I thought I would touch on sort of the broad range of things that we're looking at so you guys have a good understanding of that. The Oregon Environmental Council is the oldest statewide environmental group in Oregon. We've been around for over 30 years, and we work on a variety of different environmental issues. Generally, I try to tell people we do everything that deals with the environment except for timber and critters. So we don't deal with timber policy or wildlife or salmon policy. We'll leave those to some of the other environmental groups. So to the degree that you deal with issues that deal with that, I won't be talking to you. But to the degree that you deal with clean air and water, transportation, energy, toxics, things like that, you will be hearing from me along the way. So again, hope to look forward to working with the committee throughout this legislative session on those issues. I thought I would just highlight a couple things for you for this session. I handed out a packet that includes four sheets. The top sheet actually is the common agenda for the environmental community, and I thought I would just point that out for your benefit. For the first time this year, the environmental community has come together around a set of seven priorities for this legislative session. Those include dealing with the impacts of the passage of Measure 37, making sure that we don't roll back any current existing environmental protections we have here in Oregon, and then five substantive issues. Two of those five are OEC bills that we're focusing on, so I thought I would talk about those, as well as an additional item that OEC is also forwarding. Our top priority this session is dealing with biofuels and diesel air pollution. Diesel air pollution is the largest air pollution and air toxic issue we have here in Oregon. We have levels of diesel air pollution that exceed federal benchmarks in every county across the state, and it's a real health concern that we're starting to see more and more throughout the state. Diesel air pollution is a carcinogen, and it's also tied to increasing rates of childhood asthma. And so we've been looking at ways in which we can reduce the impact of this kind of pollution across the state. And one of the things that's come out of our work that we've been doing over the last couple of years in our outreach to the agricultural community is looking at opportunities to increase the use of biodiesel across the state. And this has dual effects of, A, helping to decrease the impacts of diesel and the pollution that comes from that, as well as helping to jumpstart that economic sector. And so we've been working with Representative Krupp and others to put together a package of legislation that can help to incent that sector here in Oregon. We're facing sort of a chicken and an egg situation where, on the one hand, you have folks who are interested in producing it, but they're not interested yet in making that investment in the kind of facilities to make biodiesel unless they know there's going to be a market. And you have folks who want to market it, but they're not sure about setting up the infrastructure to market it unless they know there's going to be the supply. So the hope is with this package of bills that we can provide some incentive for both sectors and both ends of that and really get things going and provide jobs, do something that's good for the environment and good for the economy. So that's one of the big things we'll be working with, and hopefully we can work with y'all to secure passage of those package of bills. Another issue that we're looking at is sort of the perennial favorite that it didn't seem like it would be.
Can I just ask you, Matt?
Sure.
It appears to me that one of the problems we may have, and you'd be more conversant with it, we have stacks of yellow school buses out in front of schools that tend to pull up and park and run their engines for a few 10, 15, 20 minutes as they're loading. Mm-hmm. Is that a problem in terms of the children's health?
Yes, it is. And in fact, the impact that diesel school buses have on health, particularly children's health, is an issue that's out there that we're working on. And in fact, as part of this legislation, as trying to incent the use of biofuels in the state, one of the parts of this legislation sets up 10 pilot programs across the state to actually use 100% biofuels in those school buses to actually try to reduce the pollution levels we're seeing there. So that's one approach that we're looking at. We've also been doing some outreach and education work with a number of school districts districts across the state to try to get folks to realize that idling school buses at schools actually has a real impact on children's health, and so we've been trying to get folks to reduce that and make an impact there. So, and just the idea of trying to idle less is something that we've continued to promote, and we had a bill around that last session too. So it's a good point to make.
I also understand that Representative Smith, Chair Smith, is going to be hearing testimony on biodiesel.
On Friday, she's going to be doing a hearing on those issues, so we're excited about that and starting the conversation around that, and there'll be a number of different representatives coming in to talk about that.
And just to notify the committee, we will be hearing information on another idea along that line called Fuel Catalyst. I believe it's next Tuesday. Right. So you might want to be here to hear that testimony.
Great, and I'll plan on doing that.
Thank you.
So, yeah. Our other bills that we're looking at deal with the issue that we all love and have loved for now 6 years, which is the pesticide use reporting program, which again remains in limbo for lack of funding. We'll continue to work with members to implement funding for that, which is currently in the governor's budget, and look at how can we make sure that we have a full program that provides information that can protect public health. And I won't go into that anymore unless people have specific questions. Finally, the other issue that we're looking at is dealing with toxic flame retardants. There's a set of flame retardants that have been in use for a couple of decades that we're now just starting to recognize have serious health impacts, impacting development, thyroid issues, things like that, and they're called PBDEs. And they're being recognized that not only are they having bad health impacts, but they're starting to show up in a lot of different places that we don't particularly want them. In particular, it's starting to show up in a lot of places in women's breast milk. There's been a real recognition of this and a real move in a number of different states already to start to phase out and ban the use of those toxics in a number of different products. And so we will be forwarding legislation to do that and to get ahead of the curve here in Oregon, like a number of other states are trying to do across the country.
Excellent. So, any questions?
Mr. Chair.
Yes. Representative Gerard, then Bernhard.
Matt, I'm assuming you're also representing the Oregon Conservation Network.
OEC is a member of the Oregon Conservation Network. The OCN is a coalition of most of the environmental groups across the state, so I can speak to some degree to some of those issues.
Follow, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Matt, I find something here that's a little contradictive. It says the 2005 legislature can begin to provide the long-term investments needed to create jobs in hard-hit rural areas through projects that protect fish and wildlife and repair Oregon's natural infrastructure. Do you have any idea how that would help create jobs?
Chair Anderson, Representative Gerard, and again, I can't speak to all the specifics in that proposal. That's a proposal around the Measure 66 dollars, looking at how to reinvest those in watersheds across the state to ensure that those watersheds are meeting their full riparian goals in terms of protecting wildlife and salmon. And so I think the feeling is that there's some real opportunity there for a variety of folks to have a lot of work restoring those watersheds.
That'll create a lot of jobs.
That's the goal, yeah.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Barnhart.
I haven't had a chance to read this brief on flame retardants. This material is used in a lot of different places. Is this one of the materials that's used in things like children's pajamas and that kind of thing?
Chair Anderson, Representative Barnhart, my understanding is yes. It is used in a variety of different products, although companies that have been using these have already started to phase those out, companies like Nike or Hewlett-Packard or Intel or Epson. Although I can't speak specifically to all children's clothing, it is pretty ubiquitous in a lot of different products.
Okay. A follow-up, if I may. Just looking at the list here, is this another asbestos-type problem? I mean, built into buildings and difficult to remove and get out. I see mattress carpet pads and things of that sort.
Chair Anderson, Representative Barnhart. My understanding, again, is it's more in products as opposed to structural things. So it's more like cushions, you know, maybe the chairs you're in right now, the chairs I'm in, you know, telephones, things like that. So it's more products like that that are sort of everyday use that that they're primarily used in. But again, it's sort of they're used all over the place. So.
Thank you.
All right. Any other questions? Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
Call Glenn Stonebrink from the Oregon Cattlemen's Association.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for allowing me to speak, members of the committee. My name is Glenn Stonebrink, and I represent the Oregon Cattlemen's Association. For those of you who might believe that most of the cattle producers are way off in eastern or southern Oregon somewhere, a little known fact is that the county with the highest number of producers in the state is Clackamas County. More cattle producers than any other county. There are smaller herds, but there are more of them. Cattle prices are up at the present time. That's good. The rain we had last year, be careful how I said this. I said we had some good grass and all of our ranchers were happy. Somebody said, what is that? What kind of grass are you growing? Well, forage is good. Unfortunately, with some issues with the BSC, or the better known as mad cow disease in Canada, and the border closing and so on has caused some slaughter facilities to close. So we got a few things we're dealing with in that arena. But to the environment, and I guess most things we deal with in some way or another have to do with the environment. Whether those issues will all come through this committee or not, we're not sure yet. But also, most environmental concerns deal directly with private property for public benefit most of the time, which makes me rather happy with Measure 37, because while land use gets the majority of the attention of Measure 37, Measure 37 also deals with all regulations or laws that any government places on private property that will devalue, that will cause its value to go down. And so we're looking at that in a way, and I've dealt with a few state agency folks who said, gee, we're really concerned about Measure 37 and anything we do from now on. And I said, but really, shouldn't you have done that to start with? I mean, really, shouldn't government be concerned about that? So what it does to private property. But we have here's just a few of the types of issues that we deal with. Wetlands on private property, and those are, of course, determined to be there because they have some public benefit. But they also restrict the farmer or rancher from doing certain things with their private property. Currently, the Fish and Wildlife Commission is about to, at least I believe they're about to, I'd rather they wouldn't, but they're about to adopt a wolf conservation and management plan. Presently, they've spent about $500,000 on this plan, and there are no wolves in Oregon. Wolves are extinct. That wolf that was here is gone, and it cannot be reintroduced. But they're going to go ahead with this anyway. The problem we have with that is that, and they're concerned about the wolves that were introduced into Idaho and they're coming across the river into Oregon, and I understand that. But there's no provision for a rancher to defend themselves against a wolf attack on their livestock. Or for that matter, it's a little bit unclear whether they can could defend their families from a wolf attack. We're going to try to get some of that cleared up this year in the legislature. But the wolf plan moves on to the point, and I won't belabor any more other than this one thing. The wolf plan, I get into that outrage mode when I even think about it. And let me tell you one of the reasons why. If that plan goes into have the full force and effect of law, and a wolf had there was a den of wolves, mother wolf and some pups, on your private property, I don't care how close it is to your house, and you saw them, you not only couldn't shoot them, and you couldn't throw rocks at them, you couldn't go out and holler for that wolf to get off your property, because it would be against the law to make any loud noises around a wolf den. We've dealt with, hopefully, successfully, with the sage grouse as an endangered species. It was on the verge of being listed in Oregon with a lot of help from the Fish and Wildlife Department in getting good inventories and a lot of other good folks working hard. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has decided not to list it. And the reason I bring that up is because a listing of the sage grouse would do to grazing on public lands, and there's 52% of our state is owned by the federal government in public land. That's a huge amount. But if the sage grouse were to have been listed, it would affect us like the spotted owl did to the timber industry. And you can say, well, you know, big deal. What would that do to the state? Well, while not all cattle and calves are raised on public lands by any means, there is a significant number. And the sale of cattle and calves is the number one food commodity in the state and the number two commodity overall. We've dealt with issues like salmon versus cows, and we've had good research out of Oregon State University's Range Department that has come up with something rather controversial, and that is that cattle and salmon get along quite nicely. And that has caused some problems in the scientific community because everybody said that we automatically knew that they were not compatible and cattle must leave. Another controversial issue that we must plant trees along the streams on our private property because it will cool the water, and the cooler water is needed for salmon and other fish. Another research done by Oregon State University's Range Department determined that shade does not cool water. In fact, the whole thing has to do with the air temperature. So we're dealing with water quality, wildlife, predators, and most of the time in these issues, it's asking the private landowner to change some of their activities, change some of the practices they've been doing for public good. But in addition, we had an additive of complexion, if there is such a term. In other words, to make matters worse, we deal with bad science, biased science, drive-by science, predetermined science, that oftentimes cause us a lot of expense. It costs the government a lot of expense and a lot of headaches. We have a bill this session, we just call it credible data, which will give some guidelines for at least DEQ to follow when they're taking water quality type samples so that we can get consistency. This bill was passed in Washington State and it seems to be working, so hopefully we can do that here. Other issues that we deal with sometimes are on our, especially on our public lands where we're sharing those with the public. And a lot of times recreationalists, they don't like cow pies. And they tend to join up with what I call the conflict industry to file lawsuits. Now this has been interesting and I've studied this for quite a long time. I'm not an attorney and I'm not talking about the details of a lawsuit. But I watch the organizations that file lawsuits and what happens. Those organizations that file the lawsuits have to function like the rest of us. They have to have money to pay for their attorneys and pay for their executive directors and their staff. Well, if they don't file lawsuits and in a sense become controversial or create a conflict, if they don't have a need to be, then they won't have those positions. So while sometimes I get angry and say, why are you trying to annihilate the cattle industry and the ranchers from the land, I have to back up and say that's not really their total purpose, because if they did that, if they were successful at that, then they would have to go find something else, to pick on, and probably nobody is easy to pick on as we are, because they can make claims and they have made claims, whether it be on public or private lands, and they go to court. They break the backs financially of a lot of our producers, and even if they lose the lawsuit, they've still caused us a lot of grief. If they're successful and they win the lawsuit, then they've not only put some of our people off the land, but that helps them to instigate more fundraising. I claim that our people are good stewards of the land, and we're doing better. We worked with the CAFO 2156 from a couple sessions ago to establish the CAFO rules, and our ranchers are complying. There's no longer anything that says you can just do things as usual, and if there's manure, if there's cow manure out there, you better make sure you're controlling it and it's not getting into the streams. And our people have put millions of dollars of their own money into matching funds with state and federal government to provide more habitat for wildlife. Currently, there's estimate of about, give or take, 80% of the big game type wildlife and other wildlife have their lunch on private property. And we're not objecting to that. But it does, that coupled with the things that cause our production and grief to our people is a little more than we like to bear. Presently, we have a bill that we've been accused at times not stepping up to the plate. We have a bill that we hope will pass, which will assess our producers an additional 50 cents each time an animal is sold. Currently, they are assessed $1.50 for the state program and 50 cents for the national program. But this additional 50 cents would be earmarked for certain things. And very quickly, one would be to help, I'm just going to say roughly $100,000. It would go to research at Oregon State University's Range Department, $100,000 for Oregon State's Animal Science Department, another $100,000 for image enhancement, so that we can start telling some of the stories that I'm claiming as good stewards that we're doing, and that we can tell those stories to the public through brochures, literature, but primarily maybe through the media. And we've done a little bit of that in the past. I'm not sure how well the public accepted it. I don't know if there were any surveys done. It made our people feel good. For once, we saw something nice about ourselves. That we are food producers. A lot of our ranchers are fifth generation people. They've been there a long time. They're family people. They are pillars of the community, and we'd kind of like to see that enhanced a little bit. And I'll close it there, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, and be glad to answer any questions.
No questions? Representative Lynn.
I'd like to thank you very much for the testimony anyway. And what is the total production of cattle in a year so we could sold? How many heads are there? Any ideas?
How many head are there?
Yeah, I was about sold one in a year.
Sold in a year?
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lim, it's difficult because the way cattlemen sell their cows in Oregon. We collect a dollar for each cow or bull or steer that's sold in the state or heifer. But sometimes a rancher will send their cattle to a feedlot, let's say in Kansas. Their calves, when they're weaned, they're shipped off to Kansas to be fed. And the rancher retains the ownership while they're being fed. And then when they're finally fattened and ready to be processed, they're sold in Kansas to a plant. That record never shows in Oregon that those cattle were. There's no way to determine that those are really Oregon cattle. So that it's a little hard to answer. I can say this, for those that are that there's about 800,000 that are sold, and there's a dollar collected for each one.
Okay.
But you also collect, just to make sure, you collect a dollar every time it's sold. So if you sell your calves once to a feedlot, and they in turn sell them to a processing plant, that's two times. So there's once in a while you'll get $2 on a particular animal.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Yes, Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the psychologist on the panel, would you tell us what CAFO is?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, confined animal feeding operation. I'm sorry.
Good day. Mr. Chair?
Thank you very much, Glenn.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
Can I have a moment to recognize
the people
from the Kovalas, originally from Korea? They are here to watch the process.
Wonderful. Welcome.
Can you stand up for a while? Okay.
You are Katie Lee, right?
Yes.
Okay, welcome here. Thank you.
Thank you for coming. I might just mention that the last item on our agenda here today, the Oregon Grocery Industry Association, will not speak today. They will speak on Thursday.
The
15th. So it'll be a couple weeks for Dan Floyd to come and speak to us. Next, I'd like to call in the Association of Oregon Recyclers. For the record, would you just give your name? And
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Rick Winterhalter. I am the legislative chair for the Association of Oregon Recyclers. With me today is Alex Kyler, our chairperson. And the Association of Oregon Recyclers is a trade association that has been around for about 30 years, protecting the natural resources of the state through recycling endeavors. Over the past 20 years, our members have been following the guidelines and attempting to reach the goals that are set out in the Oregon Revised Statutes of 459 and 459A. We have a membership made up of individuals interested in recycling, the businesses, government people, and nonprofit organizations. We have this crazy notion that it's probably a pretty good benefit to send some of these materials off to markets instead of entombing them in a landfill. And we've been on a daily basis. Our members are involved in contributing to resource protection throughout the state. Some of our most recent numbers that DEQ have given us from 2003 show that we've removed about 37,000 tons of particulates and other harmful air pollutants. We've conserved enough energy to fuel about 400,000 homes for a year. We've also eliminated the greenhouse gases equivalent to taking about 1 million cars off the road. So recycling is working very successfully in the state. And one of the things that excites us the most is that while providing all this public good, we're also contributing positively to Oregon's economy. And one of the easiest ways to show that 2.2 million tons of plastic, glass, metal, and paper that we've diverted from a landfill and put into markets has generated about $178 million in those prices alone. And that doesn't include the living wage jobs of the people collecting the material, all of the containers, trucks, et cetera, that are built in this effort. We're here today just to kind of let you know that we are, you know, a membership made up of a lot of different areas throughout the state, and that we can provide you information if you need on product stewardship and into the life management of materials. I think that's where our strength lies. Some of our interest, certainly if things come to you involving computer recycling or electronics recycling, which is one of the largest growing streams right now and of interest with a lot of people, we'll probably be back to talk to you again. And tires seems to pop up every once in a while, or issues surrounding tires, and we'll probably want to talk there. And any kind of market development involving materials going into recyclable products. But the one thing right now that kind of has us excited is Oregon's bottle bill. As most of you know, Oregon's bottle bill has been around for about 30 years. We were the first. It is the one that earned Oregon, a national leadership role, deserving in conservation issues. And It's had a very positive effect. It's been very, it just has a lot of positive effect over these 30 years towards the recycling efforts in the state. In fact, those containers that have a refund value are recycled at about a 95% rate. And so we can, so we have been very successful. But I think if you look, it is mentioned, you know, it's 30 years old. And 30 years ago, I think most of us were drinking our teas from a pitcher at a picnic. And I'm not sure too many people were contemplating that we'd be drinking this much key lime, kiwi, mango juice, but, you know, there it is. So all of these beverages are in containers that just weren't around during that time. So we think, the association and members, we think it's time to examine that. And we have a real opportunity to modernize the bill and bring it into the new millennium, if you will. And that's one of the feedback that we get from the public as well, as many of us do outreach, you know, at county fairs and different venues that we hear from folks. When are you going to recycle more plastics? And why isn't my water bottle have a refund value? So those are kind of what we hear. And towards that effort, the association have been, under the guidance of Mr. Kyler, we've been conducting some litter studies, which we're still refining some of those numbers, seeing what things are there or what kind of data that will show us. We've also been fortunate to speak with the grocers and the distributors and those folks processing these bottles and containers. And through that process, we've learned, Mr. Kyler and I, that, you know, this seemingly simple piece of legislation has a lot of complexities underneath it. As soon as you, it's like the big balloon. As soon as you push one place, something else, you know, bulges in another. And so we're pretty excited. We think that the makeup of our organization leads us to pursue a collaborative approach. And so we are currently talking with the Oregon Consensus Project, which has incorporated some of the former components of the Oregon Public Policy Dispute Resolution Program of the Oregon Policy Dispute Resolution Commission, which in 2003 was transferred to the Hatfield School of Government on the PSU campus. And one of the first steps that we're looking to do right now is sponsor an assessment of the issue and bring these industry people that I just mentioned together at the table, and they've all agreed to at this point. And so we hope this has us very excited, and because the collaborative process melds very well with our association, who is made up of business people and government people and have produce some of the most successful recycling efforts seen in the nation. And we're hoping that in 2007, about this time in the legislature, we're able to be in front of you and be asking for a recommendation of due pass for a bottle bill that's going to take us the next 30 years. So I wanted to thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members, for our time today, and to Mr. Hauser for remembering to give us a call. And we do have a fact sheet and another a couple of fact sheets that describe the environmental benefits that I mentioned in a little more detail, and then a little bit more about the association, and on the back has our contact information. And please feel free at any time if you think we can be of assistance. So thank you very much.
Yes, Representative Lynch.
Thank you very much. And you are talking about the our state chapter. Are you talking to any people in Washington State? Because their bodies coming to our state across the border, how come they couldn't do it in Washington State?
I think that's a fair question, and yes, we have been talking to the folks in Washington. There are, again, they have differences in their legislative process. But we are going to begin, as we go through this process, Mr. Kyler may have something else to say about it too, but we are going to be talking with them.
Chair Anderson and Representative Lim, what we find, my name's Alex Kyler. What we find to be attractive about this Oregon Consensus Program up at PSU is that it does allow us to sit at the table with the interested parties here, and one of the parties that we could invite then would be representatives from the state of Washington to see if there is any sense of regional cooperation on the issue. And no, certainly there's been some precedent set with the regional cooperation around the greenhouse gas kind of look, and as well on tire disposal issues as well.
Why you have to wait until 2007?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lim, as I said, I think the more we delved into the issue and spoke to the industry parties involved, we realized that there's so many differences in the handling process associated with new containers, and we've been very successful with what we've had, and we just really want to go through a thoughtful process with the industry, and it just seems that is going to be the right time to do that. After this session, we expect to begin that process, in earnest, to be sitting down at the table and then working through the interim.
Okay, and follow up, Mr. Chair. And I used to be a small grocery store owner myself, and I know them a lot. Even at this time, they are complaining. Especially smaller, the mom and pop grocery stores, they are bringing in a lot of dirty bottles, and they have to handle that situation, but they are not compensated for that at all. And we need to resolve that somehow.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lim, I think we understand that, and that is certainly what we heard in our discussions, and we fully intend to address that issue.
2007.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
A couple of things that you mentioned. First of all, you mentioned that you take a lot of cars off the road in terms of things that you... Did I understand that?
I was speaking as... It was a... Mr. Chair, it was in...
Saving trips?
In saving greenhouse gases. So the equivalent... using secondary materials... in the process, like paper making, that sort of thing, then the greenhouse gases are reduced in a million car equivalent.
I see. Equivalent. Good.
Yes.
Didn't catch that.
Okay.
The other question I wanted to ask is for information is where in the process, for instance, in a metal can, where in the process does your association come into the process? Are you just at the very end, or are you in the collection, or are you in the... What do you do?
Well, Mr. Chair, yes, we are in the process from the beginning to the end, and hopefully we are in the process of having the public through our outreach efforts, through our members' outreach efforts, whether it's government or solid waste collectors or in market users, promoting people to begin the putting that can in the curbside container. Our members are franchise solid waste collectors. They're the ones picking that up. And moving on, and our members are the end mills and the intermediary processors.
I guess that brings up what percentage of the metal cans show up in recycling as in non-grocery store recycling, is there any?
That's a good question, Mr. Chair. I don't have the answer for you today.
You do have percentages as to where the state is standing in recycling,
mm-hmm.
and various cities, I believe, mm-hmm. Where each city is standing. Can you give me an idea statewide what we're collecting in your recycling?
As a percentage, we're about the state...
statewide?
The most recent was 57.2%, I think, is what our most recent.
And where did that start when you first... Where did you start at when you first began the recycling?
I want to say, and I was just, Mr. Chair, I was just asking this question of somebody, and we were about 25% in 1983 when the Oregon Revised Statute 459 went into effect.
So you've doubled.
Yes, sir.
Got a long way to go, but that done well. All right, any other questions? Representative Gerard.
Rick, I know that bottlers have a big problem with those little plastic water bottles you were making reference to, because they don't recycle like soda pop cans or aluminum, etc. What's happening to the plastic water bottles right now? Where do they go?
Representative Gerard, Mr. Chair, the water bottles actually, most of the water bottles are made with a plastic that is highly recycled, and that material is being picked up curbside and at drop-offs throughout the state, and is finding markets through some of the intermediary processors here in the state. They're flakers, or the people that grind it up and then put it into the secondary market, and it is a very high value right now, and so is moving into markets.
Could I add something, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Alex Schuyler. Representative Gard, the plastic you're referring to is called PET. It's the same plastic in a water bottle that you'd find in a soda pop bottle. There is a high demand for that material, as Rick indicated, and in fact, what the domestic, on a nationwide basis, the domestic producers are saying, we need anything that will provide us with more of a supply of this kind of container. They're finding an increased demand from China as that country utilizes more resources to make new materials, and so the domestic producers are somewhat feeling a pinch to be able to do that. In California, for instance, now there's actual requirement that post-consumer material be incorporated into new products, so there's more demand coming from that state as well. So PET plastic is one of these materials that is under great demand, and in non-bottle bill states, you see about 40% of those containers being recycled, whereas in redemption states, you see a much higher in the 80 to 90, 95% recovery level of containers, and that's one of the things that we really value, is we can get more material back in a purer stream through a redemption system, and that's why it's important to us. And that purer stream is very important. As we've gone to commingled recycling on the curbside systems, we've seen an actual decline in the quality of fibrous materials and the containers. By creating strong programs that are complementary, these two systems will work in concert, and the industry will be served with a more material and a better feedstock. And what we're really seeing is this is what's interesting to me about the industry is it's gone from kind of an environmental movement, and it's really transforming itself into an industry that needs raw materials. And our association is trying to represent those business interests to get them the quantity and the quality they need.
Follow, Mr. Chair?
Paul?
Do we need to look at establishing a deposit on plastic bottles? Would that encourage more recycling?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gerard, that is one of our intents, I think, or that is going to be one of the very strong discussion at the table, is what containers, what beverages do we include in that? At this point, I think that's the feedback that we have from, you know, the public and many of our members is, you know, why not water bottles? Why not non-carbonated beverages? As I mentioned, simply because they weren't around 30 years ago in the numbers that we're seeing today.
One last follow-up.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
The bottlers, correct me if I'm wrong, they don't like having to collect those, correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gerard, I really couldn't answer for the bottlers. I'm not sure.
Could I make a follow-up point? Representative Gerard, on your last point, that industry has changed, too. Just as curbside recycling has changed and become better, the bottlers are collecting and the distributors are collecting materials and processing materials in a far different manner than they used to. So used to be that every distributor kind of had their own little recycling operation, and today in the state you'll see much larger operations that are either a cooperative or some kind of jointly owned system where they've really created a material handling company. And as I said, as these commodities now fluctuate in price, sometimes those commodities are very attractive to handle. Aluminum containers, certainly very attractive to handle on the secondary market, and PET, right now at any rate, is got some very attractive pricing. Glass containers, not so great. You know, it's a heavy material, difficult to ship and to handle. So bottlers do have some kind of mixed feelings about these, and to discuss why we have to wait till 2007. One of the issues that comes up is that water is not necessarily distributed the same way as soda pop and beer, and that brings up some new issues in terms of how do you put a deposit on that and who initiates that deposit. So these are some of the complexities that Rick talked about, and I think it really would the industry, if the industry can create the solutions and the mechanisms that will work for us for the next 30 years, that's really what we're asking for, and I think that will take a deliberative process that probably will take us a year or longer to get all those people at the table and hash out some of these issues and kind of see where that balloon bulges, as Rick was implying.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have two questions. When the initial bottle bill came up, one of the ways that the idea was sold to the public was that it was going to clean up the highways and get beer bottles and things like that off the roadways and out of the campgrounds and that sort of thing. Is that one of the incentives? I didn't hear you mention it. Maybe I missed it, but is that one of the incentives for talking about expanding deposits on more bottles now? That these materials are now finding their way, similar to the way pop bottles and beer bottles used to, into roadsides and campgrounds and other places where people take these materials.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Barnhart, yes, precisely. We conducted a couple of litter studies with that in mind, knowing that the folks who originated the bottle bill were focusing on that litter issue, and were just now kind of going through the numbers, and we may have those soon, and we'll certainly share those with you. So we think that, yes, I mean, I think it's going to be another way. These single-serve beverage containers that are leaving the 7-Elevens, maybe there will be a little incentive to keep them in the car. But, again, that's something to explore.
Mm-hmm. I'll just note parenthetically that on the way to Eugene the other day, it was apparent to me that there was a lot more trash along the road than I had noticed, and going by at the speed limit, my sense of it was that it was some of this kind of material. The second question I have is what is PET?
PET is polyethylene terephthalate, and it is a...
It's no wonder you want to use an acronym.
Yeah, it's a polyester.
It's plastic.
It's plastic, yeah. The clear plastic that a soda pop bottle or a water bottle is made of.
Thank you.
You can be thankful you're not in Senator's committee, Senator Winter's committee, because you'd have paid for that acronym. A couple questions. First of all, are there bottles that are not profitable to recycle at this time? General classes.
Mr. Chair, I think that, I hate to say this, but it does depend on your definition of profitability. I apologize for that. But I guess if you look at it from a public good standpoint, I think all of them are very profitable. If you isolate simply a market-driven, there may be some that are less profitable, yes.
Less profitable in the sense that they pile up in the recycling yard and can't be dealt with?
No, sir. There are all of this material is moving to markets that we are collecting.
That brings up a question. I know that recycling in Grants Pass is more difficult than in Portland, where the market tends to be a lot more profitable and the transportation is gone. At what point around the state, say, using Portland as a center, does it become less really profitable to do and it becomes more just for the public good?
Mr. Chair, I think all of that material, as I said, is moving to market. But you are correct that some of the material, glass does come to mind, typically stays in a regional market and may find its way to, because of the transportation issues, and may find its way into replacing mined aggregate and that sort of material, but it does typically stay in the market. At what point, I just wouldn't have the answer there.
And one final question for me. Are there other states that have water bottle deposits for the plastic water bottles?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, yes, there are. And I think, Mr. Kyler,
which states? California has a deposit on water bottles, and the state of Maine has a deposit on water bottles.
Just
those are the ones that I'm aware of. Yeah, there may be others, but I'm not aware of specifically.
California's got an unusual plan, doesn't it?
Well, California has a very complicated plan that's been fairly effective recently. They just upped their deposit. It's also characterized by a pretty large bureaucracy that is involved with it, and that's one of the things that Oregon has been noted for, is that our governmental kind of interaction is, this is an industry-run system. And again, that's the way we'd like to keep it. It's been effective for 30 years as an industry-run system. We think the industry coming together can create some benefits, and we'd like to continue to have it be an industry-run system.
Of course, that also comes from the viewpoint that you're taking. Has there any polling been done as to what price level is acceptable to the people of Oregon, so that the distributors, the retailers, really come out in a way that's reasonable for them?
Mr. Chair, we did in my county, kind of did a sample of that, and we have not analyzed that yet. But it is something that obviously a willingness to pay study or something of that nature will be necessary. So it's across the board.
Okay.
I was going to add that I believe it was the Oregon Environmental Council did a survey, and what they showed in Portland at any rate was that over 50% of the respondents to their survey liked the idea of an expanded list of beverage containers included, but more like 40% felt that a dime would be an appropriate deposit level. So there was a lot of enthusiasm for the expansion list, but less enthusiasm for paying a dime deposit. Would note, though, that the nickel is less of an incentive today than it was in 1972. That's one of the issues, is that to kind of continue that same economic incentive, I think the deposit would need to be about 22, 23 cents today. So certainly the level of the deposit is something that needs to be looked at.
One last question. Yes, thank you. Do you have any tax credit operating this barrel recycling business from the state at all? Any tax credit, any tax incentive, anything you have?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lim, the tax credit that I'm most familiar with is the business energy tax credit that can be used. I know in our franchisees use that for trucks, and it can also be used for any other type of buildings that involved recycling and that sort of activity. So.
All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate your coming.
Thank you very much for
sharing with us. Any other issues before the committee? All right. We will be meeting Thursday to. I think you have your agenda for Thursday. I guess not yet. But appreciate you all being here. We'll adjourn the meeting.